Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, Halloween. Happy Halloween, the 31st of October. The cover story of Time magazine, perhaps you've seen this, is titled The United States of Texas, Why the Lone Star State is America's Future. The article starts like this. Social services are thin, welfare benefits are skimpy, roughly a quarter of residents have no health insurance, many of its schools are less than stellar, property crime rates are high, so why are more Americans moving to Texas than to any other state? Actually, three of the five fastest growing cities are in Texas. So we thought we would talk about the Lone Star State this hour of our program, and we have two guests with us. Erica Greeter is a senior editor at Texas Monthly, based in Austin. She has been Southwest correspondent for The Economist, and her first book, which was recently published, is Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. Erica, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and also Carl Lubsdorf is joining us. He is the Washington Bureau Chief, former Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News. He writes a weekly column for that paper on its website, and he has a long history in politics in this country. He has covered the presidencies of every president from Dwight Eisenhower to Barack Obama. He apprenticed for 15 years at the AP and 5 years at the Baltimore Sun. And he started writing the column, which continues today, many, many years ago. Carl, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Kathleen, happy to be with you again.
Yeah, great to have you here. We'll be welcoming phone calls from our listeners. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Quite frankly, I had no idea so many people were moving into Texas, or that three of the five fastest-growing cities in the whole country are in the state of Texas. I don't think most people know that, do they? Carl, you want to start?
Well, I think some people know what they may not know, and what is actually the article doesn't seem to mention very much, is that two-thirds of those are Hispanics. The population growth in the last 10 years, I think 65% of it was Hispanic. And so you have not only middle-class whites moving into Texas because there are jobs available and you could get more bang for your buck, in terms of housing and things like that. But there is this tremendous influx of Hispanics, many of them poorer, and they're in many ways, I don't know if victims is the right word, and Erica would know more about this, they're the people who they don't benefit, who suffer from the state's lack of services.
Mm-hmm.
So the middle class one, whites coming in, benefit from the low taxes, and it attracts business and creates jobs at a certain level. But others are suffering from the lack of those services.
Right. I think the image that we have, Erica, from those of us who are from the Midwest and have lived here most of our lives, is kind of an LBJ, big guy, cowboy hat, cowboy boots, conservative state, although he wasn't conservative. But it does have a stereotyped image, doesn't it, the state?
Yeah, it certainly does. And I can understand where it comes from, but I think it's, for the most part, sort of over the top. And of course, as more and more Americans move to Texas, they're probably seeing that. With regard to the growth numbers, I would just add to Carl's point that it's really been a continuous story of population growth since the state entered the union. I think in 1970 we had about 11 million people in Texas, and today we're about 26 million, which is just a staggering growth rate. In the past 10 years, it's been about 4 million. And I think it breaks down about 2 million are migrants from other states, about 1 million are international migrants, and about 1 million are new births. And the kids being born especially are not Anglo. So we're already a majority-minority state, quote-unquote. We have been for about 10 years. And especially among the younger generation of Texans, we're seeing kids born, I think we're majority Hispanic, and then also African-American, Asian-American, and Anglo.
Hmm. So in a way, it's the face of what we imagine America will be more like Texas in terms of the population makeup. Is that fair to say, Carl?
Yes, I think it was, you know, it's interesting because both California and Texas, to some degree, have seen the same phenomenon of the growth of, you know, the influx of Hispanics, the situation where they no longer have a majority of white residents. Whether it will go quite that much in the rest of the country is open to question because, of course, there's a reason for it that those states border Mexico.
Right.
For many years, the Mexican economy was not that strong, and there was a great desire of many Mexicans to come here for a better life. That has slowed down during the recent recession, but it certainly creates an inordinate balance racially in those states.
Do you have, would it be fair to say that you would find this just in pockets of Texas, or can you say this general statement about the state, that it's a welcoming state, that all of those various ethnic groups get along just swimmingly?
I would say it's pretty welcoming, and it's funny because, you know, I was in Minnesota a couple of years ago, and I remember the mayor of Minneapolis had been speaking about how that city had made a concerted effort to draw immigrants and especially refugees in. And the way they had done that was by pretty active outreach, saying, if you move to Minnesota, we will offer sort of language training classes, and we can help you with these services, maybe finding public housing and that kind of thing, partly because they were, I think, looking to build a more international or global city. And Texas, it's been more, it's almost because the state is so small, the state doesn't do that much, that if you're an international migrant from Mexico or from Latin America or from Asia, you're not really going to put much strain on the safety net if you arrive legally or illegally, because there isn't much safety net to put a strain on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's we see this sort of it's almost a way of welcoming people by not being unwelcoming.
Mm.
Is how I would describe it in Texas.
So what do those people do, that population that you talked about, Carl, that it doesn't have a safety net to help them, people who are not very well off? Are there enough jobs so you can pick up some kind of job to get by, or what do you do?
Well, Erica may be more familiar with the details, but I think a lot of it is there aren't enough jobs. But while the economic situation in Texas has been better than the rest of the country, its unemployment rate is about 6.5% compared with, you know, 7.2, I think, in the country as a whole.
Right.
And I'm sure a lot of the people coming in get, of course, the lower skilled jobs. And it's interesting because the Texas business community, in fact, backing up, the Texas Republican Party until the last 10 years had always taken a very moderate stance on the whole immigration issue. And that really reflected the fact that the business community, which was the heart of the Republican Party for many years, was quite happy with the influx of Mexicans because they employed them in their businesses. And it's only in recent years, with the rise of the Tea Party phenomenon in Texas and others, you see this really anti-immigrant stance in the Republican Party. The party is really split because the Bushes, for example, have always been pro-immigration, but Texas now has two senators who are not at all pro-immigration.
Mm-hmm. The article would lead us to believe, and you've written a book about Texas, Erica, so take this on, that this is a great place to go if you are young, if you want affordable housing, if you want to do something that's rather entrepreneurial, that there are places to find work. Is that fair? Is that what's going on in Texas?
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. I think on the jobs numbers, I mean, going back the past 10, 13, 15 years, the jobs numbers are really just dispositive. We have actually really, really unusually good data on the state economy because we have a branch of the Federal Reserve Bank, which does a lot of economic research based in Dallas and pretty much covering just the one state. So they've been looking at the economy of the state of Texas from really every angle. And what they found is that there's been job growth across the board, population growth across the board. So we have seen unemployment rise a bit in recent years, but we've been lower than the national unemployment rate for every month for more than 6 years. We've seen the growth in every sector. We've also seen the growth in every income quartile, and I think that's, to me, a really salient point as somebody who, you know, is concerned about the middle class and the working class in this country. From 2000 to 2012, more than half the jobs that were created in Texas were in the top two income quartiles, so they weren't minimum wage jobs. We create minimum wage jobs too, but we also create jobs across the income spectrum. We've seen growth in every big city in the state, really every area of the state. There are parts of the state that are not doing as well, so parts of the state that have been historically poor, like in the Rio Grande Valley, are still facing worse conditions than other parts of the state. I think that's true in most sizable states. But in the big cities, we have six of the top 20 largest cities in the country. You see pretty good unemployment rates and basically a pattern of growth. And then the other side of that is that this is all happening in a state where it's still pretty affordable to live, even in the major cities. So I put the word cheap in the title of the book because I think it's really important for a state, especially for a state that is a middle-class state and wants to remain so, that you can move here as a middle-class person and still be able to afford good housing, or be able to afford a good commute, and be able to have a reasonably good school district in your neighborhood. In a city like Houston, for example, I think the median home price is about $180,000, compared to, in Boston, where it's more than four times that.
Right. You know, how does a state get by, Carl, without having an income tax? I've never understood that.
Well, first of all, it does collect money from, it does have a sales tax, mm-hmm. and it also collects money, I think, from the energy industry, but it has lower services. It spends less, I don't know the exact figures, and Erica would be able to bail me out here, but on education, but certainly on welfare-type things and Medicaid. And it's interesting because Texas is one of the states, you would think that Texas would be a state that, with the Affordable Care Act coming into play, would be relatively able to not only handle it, but because of the entrepreneurial spirit and the feeling that, Texans can do almost anything better than anyone else, that they would want to run the Affordable Care Act in Texas. But mm-hmm. the opposite is the case. They're one of the 36 states that have bailed out largely for political reasons, and it basically dumped it on the federal government, which puts them in a position then to complain about the federal government.
Well, you mentioned politics. Let's delve right into politics. I think it's also our perception that it's an extremely, extremely conservative state, that it may be the hotbed of Tea Partyism in the United States, and yet you have written that, Erica, people are notoriously ambivalent about politics in this state. They are?
Yeah, it's funny that I think one of my favorite quotes about the state came from the historian T.R. Fehrenbach, who has a great sort of single-volume history of the state called Lone Star. And somewhere, midway through the book, maybe page 600, he just is talking about mid-century politics and says, politics did not impinge that heavily on private life, which I think is kind of true. I mean, it's a limited state government, so the government doesn't do that much, right? We have a part-time legislature. They meet every other year for 140 days as the regular session. We have all kinds of restrictions on both taxing and spending, which is, basically saying we have restrictions on state action. We have one of the lowest tax burdens per capita. I mean, as Carl mentioned, there's a sales tax, and then there's revenues from industry, the energy taxes, and then there's corporate taxes. There also is a pretty high property tax burden in Texas compared to other states, but no income tax. So overall, the tax burden per capita is third or fourth lowest in the country. And then the spending rates per capita are, third or fourth lowest in the country also. And so basically the state government's job, as defined by the state constitution, is to establish the budget, which determines a lot of the policy in the state, and then to go home. And they're not really supposed to get into that much more. I mean, they do they do regulate things as needed. I mean, that's one example of that has been in fracking, which is a sort of new technology that was largely pioneered in Texas. We were the first state in the country to pass a law about disclosing what chemicals are used in fracking. So we are capable of doing that. We're also capable, of course, of doing regulations that are probably not necessary, that are done for political reasons. But in general, there's a sort of laissez-faire aspect to the government that's established in the Constitution and really reinforced by norms.
Carl Erica has written, maybe it doesn't matter if the state's leaders breathe fire, pray for rain, turn up at Tea Party rallies, and spend all day suing the government. It's Texas is really a pretty good place to live. Is that the perception you think we have nationally? That's what how politics plays out in Texas?
I'm not sure what the perception is nationally. I guess it's probably not that perception. It's maybe not even the perception necessarily in Texas. I think for me it was a matter of one day a couple of years ago walking around, and I was thinking about Governor Perry, Rick Perry, and you know who especially in Austin, which is a pretty progressive city, it's you know basically you know the Madison of Texas, right? So people don't think very highly of Governor Perry in Austin, and it just kind of occurred to me, what has he really done that offends me so much? What action has he taken that has had an adverse impact on my life or the life of my family or my friends? And you know, I couldn't really think of one. It was kind of during the prayer rally sort of days with Perry, and it's like, if he wants to have a prayer rally, that's fine. Like, that's totally, it's a free country. Go ahead, do it.
Austin is that, especially in the last few years, it seems that there has been the conservative majority in the legislature, and it's always been a conservative legislature, whether under Democratic control or under Republican control. But there's been influx, like everywhere else, of these Tea Party types, and there's much more aggressive conservatives. And so they, you know, for example, we had this tremendous fight last summer, which got national attention because the majority was pushing through tightened laws affecting abortions, mm-hmm. especially the clinics where many abortions were carried out. And you'll remember that State Senator Wendy Davis was on her feet for 13 hours with a filibuster and got national publicity, and is now turning it into a campaign for governor against the next conservative Republican in line, Attorney General Greg Abbott. So you've had this very conservative majority. And another thing that it's done, and I've written a fair amount about this subject, is you know that in many states, and I think Wisconsin is one of them too, there have been controversy about voter ID laws.
Right.
And the people who are behind voter ID laws argue that they're needed to deal with voter fraud. But in fact, every study and every effort by the Attorney General of Texas, the Attorney General of the United States under the Bush administration, has been unable to prove that there's very much fraud at all. And in Texas, the Dallas Morning News determined that of the 66 cases of voter fraud in the last 10 years, not very many, only four would have been affected by voter ID laws. And the opponents think these laws are really designed to make it much harder for the minorities, and especially the Hispanics and poor people, to vote at a time when the majority, the Republican conservative majority, is going to be threatened, if not sooner than later, by the influx of all these Hispanics and by the transformation mm-hmm. of Texas into a state where Anglos no longer have a majority. So you've had a very aggressive conservative majority in Austin.
I want to get an update on that voter ID and how Texas responded to the Supreme Court decision. We'll do that in a moment. We're talking about Texas this hour of the program. Time Magazine, interesting cover, and a whole lot of information that was brand new to me about Texas, the United States of Texas, why the Lone Star State is America's future. People are moving there in large numbers. The big cities in Texas are now the fastest growing cities in the top five in the whole United States. Did you know that? So why is what we're asking this hour? We have two guests with us. Erica Greeter is senior editor at Texas Monthly. She is a Texan, and she's author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. Carl Lubsdorf is former Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News, and he writes a weekly column for the paper. And we are welcoming phone calls. I'm sure it's a tiny world. Some of you have lived in Texas. Some of you have thought about what's going on politically in the state of Texas. What's your perception of Texas? Maybe you moved from there or you moved to there. Maybe you're listening in Texas. I don't know. You never know. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Texas is what we're talking about this hour, and let's go to phone calls again. The number is 800-486-8655. Gene in Oshkosh, hello. Hi, Gene, are you there?
Hi, Kathleen. I'm sorry, we have a very bad connection.
Oh, I'm sorry, I hear you just fine, sir. Go right ahead.
All right. I'm sure I'm going to step on the toes of your guests. And welcome, guests. but I had a son-in-law and a daughter, both taught at one of the, I'll use the term lesser, it was not the University of Texas or Texas Tech, taught at the university level for 3 or 4 years and desperately wanted to get out of there and have and are doing in a much higher class institution, but their contention was that their university students were 3 to 4 years behind the experiences that they had in here in Wisconsin. And in fact, having been a university professor myself, we checked out various indicators and would contend that the family got the level of education right. And I certainly would be willing to hear the comments of your guests.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you so much for calling. Who would like to begin?
I'd be happy to jump in on that. So I think that this is just the point about Texas schools and how our schools are not doing well enough in Texas. And I think that it's definitely true to say that our schools are not doing well enough for where we want to be, especially. I would say, too, with regard to Wisconsin, that's your state that has good schools and has had good schools for quite some time. Texas and a lot of the social services indicators and outcomes is a state that's been coming from behind for a long time and is getting better, but is not yet where it needs to be. So with regard to our school system, for example, I think if you look at the federal test scores, the NAEP scores, which is the only nationally standardized test, we see our fourth grade and eighth grade students doing about average in terms of math, science, and reading tests. When you disaggregate that by ethnicity, African-American students, Hispanic students, and white students are all in the top 5, if not top 10, compared to their peers around the country. And the reason then that the schools, on average, are performing at an average level when you don't segregate by ethnicity is because of the persistent racial and ethnic achievement gap that we see in every state around the country. So I think what that means for Texas is because we have schools that have historically not been good enough for the future of the state, and because we have a diverse school population in a country where there's been this kind of achievement gap, it's an area that is going to need a lot more attention to make sure our schools are bringing all students more equitably up to finishing high school and completion and going on to community college or college or into the workforce with better preparation. I think that's an example of the kind of thing that the state has been pretty focused on. We've seen some improvement. We've seen some restructuring in terms of policy. We've seen some city-level initiatives like San Antonio's new plan to do universal pre-K for all the students in the city. And I'm hopeful, or I guess I'm optimistic, that we're in a position now as a state because of our growth in other areas and our success in other areas to apply more resources and focus to that area in particular.
Mm-hmm. Carl, you want to weigh in on this?
Just to say that you'll recall that when President Bush, the second President Bush, was governor of Texas, education was the prime focus of his governorship and an issue that he then ran on and brought to the national level with less success than he'd had in Texas. But there's still, I'm sure, a gap in the amount of funds that are being spent, and that's when you have a large minority population, and especially when you have a large minority population where there are language issues. Smaller classes are, you know, usually seen as one way to deal with that, and if you don't spend enough, you can't have smaller classes. You can't have enough teachers to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gene, so much for your call. Let's go to Fred next in Minong. Hi, Fred.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for your program and a lot of interest. I have a couple of questions, and then I'll hang up and listen to your response on the radio. It was mentioned that 65% of increase in population in Texas was Hispanic. And I'm wondering, of that 65% increase, what percentage of that percentage would be considered legal as compared to illegal immigrants that have now moved into Texas? And secondly, my question deals with the availability of jobs in Texas, which seems to be better than most states, if not all other states. Are these jobs that are available of a type that make them more applicable to one or the other of these three groups? We've got an illegal immigrant, we've got legal immigrants, and we've got the Anglo. And I'm wondering if the jobs that are available there would apply to one or more of these groups more than the other. I'll hang up and listen
Thanks,
to your
Fred.
Response.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for the call. Erica, let's shoot that your way first.
Sure. I'm not sure how the 65% figure, I think, is primarily
That's
in
the legal
recent years,
figure.
Especially it's kids who are being born in Texas. The total figure, I think, for unauthorized immigrants in Texas at the moment is a little less than 2 million. So it's one of the biggest groups of unauthorized immigrants in the country. I think the country's figure is about 12 million unauthorized immigrants. And, of course, we are the state that has 1,200 miles of the 2,000-mile land border with Mexico, which is the country that sends a lot of unauthorized immigrants to the United States. As far as the jobs that are available for different cohorts, I think with unauthorized immigrants in the state and around the country, the vast majority of them are economic migrants. You see in studies that typically, actually, the employment rate for unauthorized immigrants is quite high, especially for the men and the family. Women who are unauthorized are more likely to be staying home with kids or with elders, but the men especially work. And industries like construction, agriculture are heavily, I think, populated by unauthorized immigrants in Texas and in other states. The other thing I'd point to as far as the kinds of jobs that are available to unauthorized immigrants or immigrants in general compared to native-born or legal workers is that we see a pretty high rate of entrepreneurial activity from those workers. And one example of that is in Houston, which is a very international metro area. I think it's been ranked as the most international metro area in the country. It has about 6% Asian American population, Asian immigrants from a variety of countries, most of whom I think are legal because they're not crossing a border; they're traveling across a great distance. The per capita business ownership rate, though, in Houston is that 12% of the businesses in Houston are owned by Asian immigrants, Asian Americans, and I think that's because if you come to a new country and you're trying to start work, and especially if you don't have the language skills to, you know, work in an office, you can start a business. And Houston and Texas in general are very, very conducive to wanting to let you open your business, your shop, without too much paperwork being filed.
Mm-hmm. The Time Magazine article, Carl, the writer says this, to Americans, Texas feels like the future. It looks like the future, a glimpse of what's to come for the country at large. In the decades ahead, Americans seeking a cheaper cost of living and, as Erica was just talking about, a less regulated climate in which to do business. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I think that is true. I think you've seen pressure in even states that have more regulation and, a stronger state government in some of them to reduce that and to reduce the amount of regulation at the state level. Might say on regard to the previous question, the 65% figure is the legal figure because it's the figure that came out during the debate on reapportionment in Texas, that the issue in Texas got four new House seats, and the figure that was used, and that's based on the legal population from the census, and 65% of the growth was Hispanic, and there was the big fight was between those conservative Republicans who wanted to take all four new seats for the Republicans and the Democrats and their allies who felt a 2-2 split was, made more sense. And the case ended up in court, and at the moment it is a 2-2 split because of that.
I also wanted to ask a follow-up on this voter ID question. What did Texas go ahead with when the Supreme Court gave their ruling on the constitutional question?
They went ahead the next day and reinstated their law, which their law had not passed muster with the Justice Department under the preclearance procedure that was at stake in the Supreme Court argument. And as soon as the Supreme Court threw it out, Texas went ahead and put their law into effect. The Justice Department subsequently has sued Texas on the grounds that its law is discriminatory. What the Supreme Court did is they didn't throw out the Voting Rights Act totally. They threw out the preclearance provision. So now you can prove after the fact that something is discriminatory rather than getting the clearance before the fact. And this is the first election since then. A lot of municipal offices are at stake. And one reads in the papers of a number of cases, they've had a real problem, something that I don't know if anyone thought this would be the problem, of women coming in who have their maiden names as their middle names instead of their original middle name, or have hyphenated names and it's different on their driver's license from the way it is on the official rolls, and are running into a lot of trouble. There was a judge in Corpus Christi who's, you know, been in public service and public life for many years, and she had to file to get one of the affidavits to affirm that she really was the person who was the person on the voter roll, because there was a difference between her driver's license and the official voter roll. That's one of the problems with this whole procedure. Many people are not going to, you know, if they get challenged, aren't going to follow through with it, and will get discouraged. And as I said, those of us who are critical of it, and I recognize there's another side, feel that its entire purpose is to hold down voting.
Mm-hmm. Erica.
It's funny. I was going to add to Carl's point. I think that both Wendy Davis, who's the presumed Democratic nominee for governor next year, and Greg Abbott, who's the likely Republican nominee for governor, currently the attorney general, who's been involved in a lot of these fights about Texas voter laws, I think they were both asked for to sign affidavits, too, when they went to vote in this year's election. So, clearly it's I think it's in general a dumb law. I don't like voter ID. I think it's probably unconstitutional. You had the figure before, Kathleen, about how rare it is for voter fraud to actually happen by somebody impersonating a voter. I mean, there is a history of some voter shenanigans in Texas, but that's not the way it happens. It's not that you pretend to be somebody else and vote the way you would like that person to vote. Of course, for the party that's supposed to be skeptical of bureaucracy, to add a layer of bureaucracy to the system, you would think they would perceive the possibility for paperwork trouble and inefficiencies. But I think that and the legal fights about this are going to be ongoing, and there's cases being made on both sides about it. It seems to me like one of those sort of red meat gestures that resulted in a state which, as I was saying before, is generally pretty business-focused, pretty pragmatic, but, you know, every once in a while there's something that comes up, and it's partly a result of the fact that the state has been so heavily dominated by Republicans for several decades, so that all the action in the state political sphere, for the most part, happens in the Republican primary rather than the general election. The Democratic Party is basically, it's just been completely stagnant lately. They do have a candidate for governor now. But we, as a state, don't see a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in the 2014 election. We have we'll have contested elections for other statewide executive races, but for the most part, all the action next year, apart from on the governor's race, where there's two interesting candidates, is going to be happening in the Republican primary. So there's this built-in tendency for the party to get farther right because they're trying to differentiate themselves as the true conservative or the more conservative person in the race. And I think that's the kind of tendency that ultimately, if we see the state turn blue, to use that heavily overused phrase, it'll be partly because the Republicans got so far to the right that they got really out of step with the people of the state as a group.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting election time, that's for sure, those midterms. We're talking about Texas. Time Magazine this week the United States of Texas. All the states in the country blend into one, and it's in the shape of Texas, if you haven't seen the magazine, Why the Lone Star State is America's Future. Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly, author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. Carl Lubsdorf, former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. He writes a weekly column now for the paper and for its website. What about the hot part of that title? I don't know how people can work when it's like 100 degrees. Yeah, how can you go outside? I mean, doesn't that make a difference in terms of attracting people to a state? It may seem like a simple thing, but it seems like a big thing to me. So some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Texas. Others know a bit about it. We certainly all know the politics of Texas because Governor Perry and Wendy Davis and others have been, and certain issues have been bubbling up from Texas and making national news. Do you think that it is America's future in some ways in terms of population mix, in terms of politics, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of get the government off my back? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls as we talk about Texas. Greg in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, I read a book recently called The Big Rich by Brian Burroughs, in which he describes Senator Jill McCarthy of Wisconsin as the third senator from Texas. And I'm wondering how Texans consider Scott Walker in terms of his catering to the extractive industries.
Carl, I don't know. Are you Scott Walker?
Carl, you want to take that?
I have no idea.
I saw Scott Walker speak once in Texas a couple of years ago. It was at the there's a free market think tank in Austin, and so he was the keynote speaker. And I thought he gave a very good speech I don't know if he's been giving this speech in Wisconsin also, but it was a good speech because he basically sort of gave a short version of the fiscally conservative, pitch, but didn't really stay on that and didn't talk too much about his fights with organized labor and so on. He then went out and said that he thought, as a conservative, where the conservative movement is not doing well enough, he said that he thinks the party needs to be more attentive to the fact that there is going to be a government, and the government does have core responsibilities, and it has to be able to do those things well. It has to be able to provide, effective funding for schools, and has to be able to provide the services it does consider part of its purview credibly and consistently, even if you're a small government conservative. So I thought that was a good line or a good approach from a Republican governor.
Here's somebody.
How that would be as an approach for the Texas Republican Party, which is, people outside Texas often don't realize how conservative it is. And I think the rise of Senator Ted Cruz is giving a hint to that. The man who Cruz beat last year, Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who is an establishment Republican, really quite conservative, but not as far to the right as Cruz. And since he lost the election for the Senate, he's running now for re-election as Lieutenant Governor. And among the other things he's done in this campaign is he's called for President Obama's impeachment.
Oh my.
And he and the other candidates for Lieutenant Governor have all supported the repeal of the Texas law, which Governor Perry supports and which he got into trouble last year nationally, whereby the children of illegal immigrants in Texas qualify for the in-state tuition break that other Texans qualify for. And this was considered too liberal and too, too pro-immigration for the National Republican Party that booed him when he said these things. And now Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst and his opponents have all come out against it. Mm. So they're all, as Erica said, that they can't resist going further and further to the right in an effort to win these primaries.
And if you did like a popularity poll today on Senator Cruz, would you find a 50-50 split in Texas concerning whether or not they embrace him? Or
there was a poll of
preferences for 2016, and it was, oh, about 4 or 5 months ago, I think, and he came in first, and Perry came in fourth.
Really?
Yeah, and that was national, I think, not Texas. And for Texas specifically, I don't know if we've had any.
That was Texas.
That was Texas.
And yeah, I might have been saying poll then, Carl, but he had higher approval ratings than anybody, any other statewide politician, at least before the pseudo filibuster and so on. But we haven't seen any polling since the past, you know, month and a half or 2 months. And it's funny because what's happening in Texas in that sense, it does seem to be a little bit of a national phenomenon, too. And I think I see it slightly differently from Carl. I think with Senator Cruz, for example, I think he's certainly pretty assertive, and he's pretty forthright about having a political fight. I see him as being more focused on fiscal issues, I mean constitutional issues, than on, for example, social issues. And I asked him recently, working on a profile of him for Texas Monthly, is there room in your idea of the Republican coalition for social liberals, people who, you know, are pro-choice or support gay marriage? And he said, yes, of course. Those aren't my views, but of course there's room for people who have those views in the Republican coalition. In some ways, he's not rabidly far right, I don't think, on everything, but I think the perception has been that the way to win in Texas, because of the Ted Cruz, David Dewhurst race, is to go farther and farther to the right. And so people are sort of clamoring to see more far right, whereas even 10 years ago they weren't that way. So the immigration bill mentioned, it was the quote-unquote Texas Dream Act, giving in-state tuition for certain unauthorized students. That passed the legislature and was signed by Governor Perry with nearly unanimous support. It was not a controversial bill. It was just seen as, you know, pragmatic and a reasonable thing to do. Like, why would you want to cut a student who finished high school off from being able to go to college? But then today, and you saw in the 2012 primary, how unpopular that was. So I think people, it's like the party's almost, you know, spooking itself for no reason.
Yeah. Does he ever crack a joke? He strikes me as a really humorless guy, Carl. Cruz.
Cruz?
Yeah. Cruz.
Well, he did read, you know, he did read Dr. Seuss stories when he was filibustering. That was sort of a joke.
Okay. It's as far as it goes. Jim in Austin, Texas is listening to us, and he sends an email. Neither critics of Texas nor supporters have said that the state's having weathered the worst recession since the Great Depression could be largely because it doesn't provide the benefits and services Texas is accused of not having, things that have largely ruined other states fiscally. What do both of you say to that? Carl, you want to start?
Well, it's certainly been a burden fiscally on some of the states. That's although we have the example of California, where because the Democratic majority was so great in the legislature, Governor Jerry Brown has been able to improve the fiscal situation of the state dramatically by including not only cuts in some government agencies, but by raising some taxes. And many states have had the same fight that we've seen nationally, whereby there's been resistance by the Republicans into adding revenues to keep the states afloat fiscally. And states have a special problem because they have to balance their budget every year. So when revenue drops because of the recession, they're in a very difficult position, and they have to start cutting services dramatically. They don't have much choice.
Mm-hmm. Becky in Pulaski, hi.
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 Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question. It's how many military bases are there in Texas? And the reason I'm asking is, there's money that the states send to the feds versus the money that the feds or jobs that the feds give back. Wisconsin's pretty low on the rate of return. I was just wondering how Texas is doing. I find it kind of ironic that not too long ago the governor of Texas wanted to secede from the union when so many jobs down in Texas are federal jobs. Thank you.
Thanks, Becky.
Can I answer that?
Sure, go ahead.
A military brat.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it's a great question. It's a big military state. It has been for most of the 20th century. I think we have more than a dozen military bases and various installations. San Antonio is probably the biggest military city in the country where I'm from. It has several bases, Air Force, Army, Cyber Command is in San Antonio, Fort Sam Houston, Randolph Air Force Base, a lot of VA and military medical operations are there also. Out in El Paso in West Texas, you see major growth at Fort Bliss, partly because of its access to the White Sands Missile Range. They can do a lot of collaboration and research out there. So that's been certainly, I guess, somewhat of a stabilizer because the military families in Texas, it's about 2 million people in the service or their families and their kids. And they're, you know, federal employees, and they have been fully employed during the past 10 years. But overall, Texas is, unlike a lot of the red states in the South, Texas is still a net contributor to federal tax receipts. So between 1991 and 2010, if I'm recalling correctly, this was from an analysis in The Economist, we were one of the states that sent more money to the federal government than we took back.
That's still the case. In fact, I think it was an issue in the governor's race when Senator Hutchison ran against Governor Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And she was accused of not getting enough money for Texas.
Yeah, and that was kind of a funny line of critique about her. It may be the wrong policy, but the state's not being hypocritical about it. I think it is genuinely a state that does not spend a lot of money, and it's pretty efficient with what it does spend. So, for example, our schools, we spend about half per capita on public schools that California does. Of course, again, we're in a cheaper state to live and work and educate people in than California is. But despite that lower funding level, our schools perform better as a system than California's do. So.
All right, let's go to Scott in St. Francis. Hi.
Hi there. I lived in Dallas-Fort Worth area for 16 years before I moved back up here to Wisconsin. It is terribly hot down there, that's for sure. That's one of the reasons I moved up here. But I just thought I'd mention that while I lived down there, I saw Ann Richards as governor. And I'm not mistaken, she didn't get beat by very much by George W. Bush. And some of the people, a lot of the people from outside the country probably think Texas is so Republican, but I thought it was pretty much 50-50 with a lot of people like Jim Hightower and Molly Ivins and Ann Richards having that perspective. A lot of people feel that way down there. So.
Thank you, Scott. Carl?
In fact, the caller mentions the names of two of the last Texas Democrats to win statewide races. The Democrats have not won a single statewide race since the 1994. The last race they won was in 1994.
That's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago, and I think most people think that will continue next year. One of the big debates that goes on among Texas Democrats, and Republicans too, is how soon will it be time for a Democrat to have a real chance to be elected governor or senator. And there's been a lot of talk about the Castro brothers from San Antonio,
right,
one of whom's in the House now and one of whom is mayor, whether they would run statewide. And they sort of made it clear they're quite happy with their current jobs because they know it's premature to run statewide and be elected. And Wendy Davis is now running as the Democratic candidate for governor. She will get a lot of enthusiasm from Democratic core groups, but very few people outside the inner circle there think that she has much chance of winning. And so it's going to be another 4, 8, 12 years, possibly, before the Democrats have a real chance to win a statewide race.
Mm. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us, both of you. It was really an interesting hour, and we appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks, Kathy.
Happy to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks, Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly, author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. And Carl Lubsdorf is the former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. He writes a weekly column for the paper and its website, dallasnews.com. And you're also if you're interested, invited to go to the Time Magazine, their cover story, The United States of Texas, Why the Lone Star State is America's Future. For those of you who listen to us regularly, you know that our longtime producer, Rhonda Fanning, is moving to Texas, Austin. She's been with us for 7.5 years, and just by chance, the day that she decided, I think, to take the job, the Time Magazine article came out. So there is something about people starting lives and continuing their professions in the Lone Star State. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody.